Hello, welcome to Converging Dialogues. This is Xavier Bonilla. Okay, so for those of you that have gotten used to three episodes a week, that is going away for now. I mostly did that in the spirit of trying to get caught up on a crazy backlog that I had, and I'm pretty much there. So back to twice a week, Mondays and Thursdays, and probably in the summer, I'll this summer be doing one episode a week, which is good and bad. It's, you know, a bad thing because it's less conversations that I'm posting, but it's a good thing because it can give listeners a chance to catch up on some of the past ones I've released. And sometimes the week kind of routine is nice and steady. So yeah, a couple more months of Mondays and Thursdays, and then probably a few months of once a week, and we'll see what's going on in the fall to see if we want to go back to twice a week per the kind of standard. So I greatly enjoy this. As busy as I am doing my day job and doing regular life stuff, this is such a labor of love. I enjoy it. All wonderful guests and wonderful people. I can't turn down a really good conversation, and it's just so illuminating. It's fantastic, and I still have so much energy for having these types of conversations. Today, I am talking with James Traub. James is a journalist and scholar specializing in international affairs. He's a columnist and contributor various places. He's worked at The New Yorker. He's been at the New York Times Magazine. He writes extensively about national politics, urban affairs, education. He teaches at NYU. He's also on the Council for Foreign Relations. And he's written many books, including the most recent, True Believer, Hubert Humphrey's Quest for a More Just America. And that is what we talk about. For those that don't know, Hubert Humphrey was the vice president under Lyndon Johnson. Full term on his own that he got elected in 64. And he was a senator, and he was a kind of a underrated and lesser known figure, but such a giant for what we would say progressive ideals, liberal ideals, some of the differences there. Just a fascinating person. So I was very happy to talk with James, and his book is absolutely fabulous. We start the conversation by defining liberalism. James has written a previous book about liberalism, which people should check out. We talk about the background and context of Humphrey and his internal motivations as he was growing up and how he got into politics and speaking. We talk about how he governed as mayor in Minneapolis and how instrumental he was there. We talk about how he was a liberal and a progressive. We spend a little bit of time teasing out these differences and why that's very important to tease out and why it's still important today. We talk about his time as U.S. Senator, him being a Cold War liberal, and of course his relationship with Lyndon Johnson. We talk about Humphrey's foreign affairs work, his time as Vice President of the United States, his Senate years post-Vice Presidency in the early 70s, the legacy of Humphrey, and many other topics. This was such a wonderful conversation. James is fabulous. And how to communicate his life and his work. He's such a nice person, such a joy to talk to, and his book is just great writing and just brilliant all around. So I highly recommend folks to pick that up. As always, you can find this conversation and all other conversations at convergingdialogues.substack.com. That's the best place to find my stuff. Of course, you can listen to Apple, Spotify, anywhere else. I'm also on YouTube, but really helps to subscribe on both places, actually. Substack and YouTube is a good resources there in terms of spreading the podcast. So sign up. It's free. Of course, you can contribute if you'd like. Word of mouth is still the best way, which I like people to hear about the podcast. So tell your friends, share online, all the good things. And now I bring you James Traub. I am here with James Traub. James, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I'm greatly looking forward to speaking with you.
Javier, I'm delighted.
Yeah, well, I know that you're a busy guy and you've got a lot of things, and so you're very kind to come on and talk about your fabulous book, which is called True Believer, Herbert Humphrey's Quest for a More Just America. Some people may know Humphrey as the vice president under Lyndon Johnson, and the only term he was elected for, but the second term, I guess. But he is quite the figure in American politics in the 20th century, as a progressive, as a liberal, and really just a good champion for many things. So we'll talk all about it. Before we do, would you tell listeners just a kind of snapshot of who you are, professionally, academically, all the particulars, and what you're currently doing?
So I have been a journalist for nigh on 50 years. I'm not quite 70 years old, so it's not quite as long as that. And I've written for every magazine that your listeners have ever heard of in their whole lives. About 35 years ago, I started writing books. And so I've written books on a pretty wide variety of subjects, though in recent years, I've really become much more of a biographer and historian. I wrote a biography of John Quincy Adams. I wrote a short biography for the Yale Jewish Lives series about a person named Judah Benjamin, who I'm guessing very few of your listeners have heard of, and I'm happy to talk about him some other time. Wrote a book about liberalism called What Was Liberalism? With that doomy past tense title. And it was that which led me to write about Hubert. And I should also add that for the last 13 or 14 years, I've been a teacher at New York University as well.
Very, very nice. I guess what's the, as a writer and as an author, you've talked about how you've written, kind of short pieces or in publications, writing books and biographies. I guess are some of those things kind of intentional, or is it just kind of, you're poking around at one thing and one project leads you kind of open to more questions that puts into another project? I guess, how did you get to writing more, biographies, and how did you pick certain people? I mean, John Quincy Adams is an interesting figure. He's great, but not someone that people usually think about right away. And same with Humphrey. How do you kind of get involved in these projects, I guess?
Well, maybe the book writing thing is, and I'm getting older thing, and so the kind of world of writing a million magazine articles a year seemed a little fatiguing. What the figures I've written about have in common is that they're all political figures. And so I'm writing political history, and I'm writing about people I'm fascinated by. And so it's not as if the people are just a means, but they allow me to write about a canvas or to paint a canvas, which is really the canvas of political history. In the case of Adams, which was my first, it happened because I was about to begin teaching a class. I taught for quite a few years at New York University's Abu Dhabi campus. And I was about to begin teaching a class in U.S. foreign policy. And so I was reading up on history. And Adams was a great, great Secretary of State. And I thought, I should find a good book on him to learn more. And it turned out the great biography of him had been written in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, that's fantastic. This is like uncovered founding father material. or almost founding father anyway. I found him a fascinating figure. And it was just a great joy for me to spend 3 years of my life or whatever it was thinking about, reading about, and writing about John Quincy Adams. And that then set me on this path.
It's interesting how he is a very interesting figure. Much of what I was reading about in the current one about Humphrey, I kind of felt kind of a unwritten kind of force behind the book is this question of, what is liberalism? What was it in the 20th century? We have many ideas about FDR, LBJ, Kennedy, this kind of liberalism. And, but I couldn't help but think about, in reading his story, how we're still asking that question of what is liberalism? How much of it is tethered to the liberalism of the 20th century in the, let's say 40s to 70s? and how it's evolving and how it's continuing to evolving. So how does Humphrey go as a kind of figure that people don't really think about or talk about and seen as this giant for progressivism or for liberalism? What is it about his work and legacy that's important to know for us today and why we should examine some of his achievements?
Well, so I think, you know, the question, at least for the purpose of this book, is why is liberalism worth caring about?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's this word. I'm old enough that when I was a little kid, everybody was a liberal. Liberal meant you're okay. Conservative was you're a caveman. You're nuts. Or you're just backwards. You're backwards. You know, you don't like progress. You stand athwart history shouting stop, as William Buckley put it. And because you can talk forever about what liberalism is. Do you mean 19th century liberalism? Do you mean the liberalism of John Locke? So I wrote a book about that, but this is not that one. This is a book about one particular kind. And so Humphrey is to me the incarnational figure. If you don't like him, you don't like liberalism, and the other way around. Liberalism in its modern American sense. He's an FDR liberal. And to be perfectly simple, that really means you're a social democrat. So it means you believe in capitalism, you believe in free markets. Hubert Humphrey's father was a pharmacist. He was a classic small businessman in a little town in South Dakota. Hubert grew up working in the store. He believed devoutly, not only in private enterprise, but just hard work. He just thought that's the essence of life, is hard work, self-reliance. But at the same time, he lived through the Depression. We can come back to this later if you'd like. Saw how people suffered, saw how government was able to stand them up again under FDR, and that had a very profound influence on him. So Hubert, his whole life long, I think, carried that message of government as a force for good, of liberalism as compassion, faith in the future, optimism, hopefulness, moderation in terms of means. Hubert was a pragmatist who always said, if I can't get the whole loaf, I'll get a half. If I can't get a half, I'll get some crumbs. It's enough. And I think that spirit, you know, especially now, we'll come to how Hubert's destroyed in the 60s. But we today again live in a moment where people are being wrenched to either side. And a person like Joe Biden, who is a somewhat Humphrey-esque figure, is, of course, despised by conservatives, but he's also held in contempt by many people who call themselves progressives and who think he's too much of an incrementalist, a gradualist, a pragmatist. Well, Hubert would have said, that's the only way you get things done. Politics is not a sphere of purity. It's this contest of inevitably conflicting ideas. You have to find a way of working with people who disagree with you. You try to persuade them, but in the end, you're just going to have to work together somehow. You take what you can get with the hopefulness, the faith that you'll be able to get more of what you believe is right over time. And I think that combination of genuine idealism with real pragmatism is, to me, that's kind of the core of the whole enterprise. And it's a thing that I think we're losing now, that the willingness to use the language of pragmatism and not be accused of surrendering and of being a person without real convictions. That's a thing that we need to remember and cherish.
I would firmly agree. I mean, myself and many of my friends, people I you know, circles I run in, we go on and on about this whole idea of we need to have more pragmatists, you know, people that are, you know, using institutions in a way, again, not where you rest on your laurels. We should be pushing for, you know, change in good ways, but you need to do things practically. You can't, if you want a big country with a lot of diversity and different people and different ideas and all these things, it's not going to be just one way of doing things. And I think that was definitely true during you know, the 50s and 60s, but it's way more true now in terms of how, you know, things have expanded in the US. So I feel like his story is super important to kind of see exactly that kind of ethos of how to try and manage policy, or how to, you know, we'll talk about it, but, you know, he was a great public speaker, and how to really move people, and using that kind of practice as well. So
I should say that there's one crucial and very painful, and there are many, but one really crucial difference between his time and ours, which was at Hubert's time, it was possible to use the legislative process, the national legislative process, to shape an agenda.
Yeah.
And that was possible because the two parties did not have rigid outlines the way they do now. And neither one thought that its ultimate goal was to destroy the other. They both really did think that they were competing. They had competing visions of what was right, and that they would fight with each other, but also work with each other in order to craft legislation. Well, it's almost impossible to do that now. You know, I have this little Substack that I write called A Democracy If You Can Keep It, which is about the dangers of democracy and what we can do. And I wrote a piece a few weeks ago that said, we never talk about anybody anymore as a legislative craftsman.
Mm-hmm.
That was a word used about Sam Rayburn 80 years ago. And it was a word used about Lyndon Johnson. It was a word used about Humphrey and Teddy Kennedy and Harry Reid. And all sorts of people up until maybe 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
The word doesn't exist because the function doesn't exist because you can't.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it's such a sobering thought, but I agree with you. And yeah, I worry because we have real big issues. We can't have everything just on rhetoric, or, you know, just on, you know, how many clicks or likes you get. We do need people to actually be putting forth good policy. I think, I mean, we don't have to open this can of worms, but I think a big problem that is suffering because of this issue is immigration. I mean, we've needed to have really good policy chops on this for 40 years, and we don't. We don't have it, and we're paying the price for this. So I fully agree. There's many issues. I fully agree.
Yep.
So. We don't have to spend too much time on this, but I guess just kind of the two things. The context in which the world in which Humphrey kind of was raised, and then also some of the internal motivations. So two big things here. He grew up definitely within the Great Depression. That had an impact. You know, he's from South Dakota. He ends up finding his way to Minnesota. He sojourns in Louisiana. But throughout this time, he really became aligned with kind of the New Deal Democrats, you know, with FDR, probably more so than the average person. How much do you think, for when he's in very much in public life, you know, starting out as mayor, but really as senator and VP, how much this period and understanding this time frame economically or even globally, because he has a foreign influence as well, really shaped kind of his thinking about how to govern, how to do things?
Well, so I should talk about a few different kinds of influences on Hubert as a young man.
Sure.
So first, he grows up in what is an almost mythical small town. You know, if he were from our own age, we would be hearing about him the same way we heard about Bill Clinton as, you know, the boy from Hope.
Yeah.
So Hubert was the boy from Doland, South Carolina, a tiny village almost exactly halfway across the country. It's eastern South Dakota. And so he grows up with these prairie sensibility, a simplicity of character, an enthusiasm, a hopefulness, a kind of all-American hopefulness. So that's one thing. He's a religious person in just the sense that everybody is. It's a very homogenous Christian world. He's a church-going boy because everybody was a church-going boy. So also a certain kind of early 20th century Christian religiosity. At the same time, his father was a very unusual man. His father was a profoundly thoughtful, largely self-educated man, a pharmacist, as I said before, but a person who read Voltaire, a person who would go to Minneapolis to hear a classical concert, a person who was a free thinker, was probably the only guy in Dolan who didn't go to church, until finally a new minister came who was actually as erudite as he was. And then he broke down and not only went to church, but became the most popular Sunday school teacher in Dolan, South Dakota. So Hubert grew up with this deposit of a kind of evangelical faith, a deep belief in America, a kind of intuitive patriotism, a hopefulness about America, and this deep progressivism that he got from his father. His father probably was basically a socialist. That was an ancient tradition among the Scandinavians of the Midwest. So that's Hubert as a boy. The Depression in the Midwest is a different thing from the Depression that we know of bankers jumping out of buildings on Wall Street. Mm. The Depression arrives much earlier. It arrives around 1925 when farm prices collapse. And so Hubert, as a boy, as a 14-year-old, sees his neighbors losing hope. His father is forced to sell the house Hubert grew up in. Ultimately forced to move out of Dolan to a bigger town where the pharmacy can do better. And so he sees this suffering with his own eyes. And then 1933, Hubert's 22 years old, FDR becomes president and speaks hope into being. The South Dakotans, who had never voted for a Democrat in their whole lives, vote overwhelmingly for FDR against Hoover. And FDR immediately says to them and to Americans throughout the Farm Belt, help is on the way starting now. Hmm. And tens of millions of dollars poured into farm country to provide price supports and to provide employment to unemployed people. And it was like water on parched ground, like literally. Hmm. And so that was Hubert's original and deep and abiding political inspiration. Hmm.
You mentioned his dad. In the book, you talk about his dad and then also his mom. And what was it, I guess, where you mentioned how when he's young, he starting to see, I mean, obviously impacted by events at the time, the Depression, but also where he really started to think about many of the ideas about other people. And then he starts to have a kind of reckoning with racial relations as well. Definitely when he's down in Louisiana in the 20s, he starts getting involved in politics and in public speaking. What were the kind of internal motivations that he was having for wanting to help others, but also use politics or use his oratory abilities to try and attain that?
So there was no such thing as civil rights in the world that Hubert Humphrey grew up in. There were no black people. There was virtually no Jews. There was one Catholic family. It was a homogenous world. Mm. But he would later say, when people asked him, where did your passion for civil rights come from? And he said, well, it came from my father. It came from church. It came from the town where I grew up in. And I believe it's true. That is, he later read things and learned things and came to have a theory about things and a critique. But it was him. It was the world he grew up in, which said, every man is your neighbor and love your neighbor as yourself. That's what he learned. His father said in an interview when Hubert had become mayor, his father said, in our household, we never high-hatted anyone. A lovely, now long-gone expression to high-hat someone. Everyone was treated as an equal. I mean, it was his father would have said, well, that's what it means to be an American. And Hubert would have said the same thing. So that was the foundation of everything. Now, as you said, Hubert goes to college at the University of Minnesota. He does it very late because owing to the Depression, he has to work in the pharmacy for 6 or 7 years when he should have been out building a life for himself. So everything happens late. And so he goes to LSU, where he's able to get a scholarship for $50 a month, which even then was nothing. Even in Louisiana in 1939 was nothing. He's in a political science, getting his master's. And for the first time, he sees Black people and he sees Jim Crow. Now, Hubert was well-read. He knew all about Jim Crow. He knew what it was, but he hadn't seen it. He hadn't seen it. And so everywhere he went, you know, if you got on a bus, there was a sign somewhere a little towards the back that said for colored patrons. And if you went to a doctor's office, there was a line on one side of the building for colored patients and a line on the other for white people. That was that world. And so he was very shocked by that. And I think, you know, shocked into a recognition that America's problems were in matters of race were really, really profound. Mm. And that certainly helped push him in a direction that I think he was already going and perhaps would have gone in whether he had gone to LSU or not.
Mm. Mm. It's interesting because then it seems like kind of seeing it or experiencing that you know, racial relations in this way kind of almost in some ways charts him on a course of really trying to enact, you know, legislative policies and to really try and connect with people in ways that there could be a real difference. When he becomes mayor of Minneapolis in 45, he focuses on crime control, fighting racism, aligning with unions, working class people. Again, what was the emphasis here? I guess maybe you can talk a little bit about what Minneapolis was going through. What were the perceived issues of Minneapolis in 45?
It will be hard for your listeners to imagine today when Minneapolis is the very epitome of high-minded, prosperous, progressive, woke, etc. Mm-hmm. Back in them days, because in large part, it was the largest big city near Canada. Mm. During Prohibition, it became the great transshipment point for bootleg liquor. And that in turn brought in organized crime. Mm. And there were two huge organized crime rings. One controlled out of Chicago, one out of New York, that really had a hammer lock on Minneapolis in the early 1940s. I mean, the national football line was set in Minneapolis. Mm. So that's what bookies, the odds bookies would give you. So Hubert, the first thing he said is, we're not going to stand for this. We're going to crack down on crime. And he basically found about the biggest, scariest, and also oddly most sophisticated and well-educated cop he could, Ed Ryan, and made him head of the force. It was literally the only appointment that the mayor of Minneapolis under the city's charter had was police chief. And he made Ed Ryan police chief, and Ed Ryan cleaned up the gangs, certainly within about 3 years or so. So that was one thing that endeared him to the city. Then he did a thing that nobody was calling for at all, and that was civil rights. And so Minneapolis also was an infamously anti-Semitic city. Mm. And so Jews, and there was a sizable population of Jews in Minneapolis, couldn't join even things like the Rotary Club, much less a country club. They were really kept utterly apart, though it was a relatively prosperous community. Mm. And there were a series of very bad anti-Semitic incidents beforehand. And Hubert said, I'm not going to let this happen. Now, if you were even mildly cynical, you'd say, well, sure, because, you know, Jews are our big voting bloc and they had voted for Hubert. And so he was, you know, paying them back. You could not say that about Black people. There were very few Black people in Minneapolis. There was no political value in helping them. And there was potential real political harm in helping them. Hubert took up both causes passionately. He, in the years before, he had spoken at every synagogue and every Black church anywhere in the Twin Cities. And he knew people, he knew Black leaders, he knew Jewish leaders. And he said, I'm going to do what I can do. So he impaneled the Mayor's Commission on Civil Rights. And he had limited abilities to do anything as mayor. So what this could do is it could gather information. So he had a prominent Black social scientist whom he hired to run a kind of survey where he had literally thousands of volunteers fanning out across Minneapolis and saying to employers, to churches, to organizations, schools, universities, what is the situation of Jews and Blacks in your world? Do you hire them? How do you treat them? And they compiled a record. Now, the record was very useful, but what was probably more important was mobilizing the citizens of Minneapolis to do this, to do it together with each other, and to create the idea that if you are a decent person, you will find this intolerable. So all by itself, that changed the atmosphere of Minneapolis. Now, there was one specific thing that he was really bound and determined to get, and that was what was called a Fair Employment Practices Commission. Now, that word meant non-discrimination, and above all, non-discrimination against Black people, since they were the ones who were suffering discrimination on the job front. And FDR, under tremendous duress, had established a temporary FEPC during the war. Outside of that, they didn't really exist. A few cities had talked about it. And Hubert said, we're going to have an FEPC and it's going to be for real, meaning that if you violate its terms, you can be punished. And it took an enormous amount of effort to get this through an extremely reluctant city council, where Hubert had a lot of informal power, but very little formal power. It passed. And it passed in a meaningful form. It was never able to do a lot while Hubert was there. He was gone within a year, but it was a tremendous model. I mean, people, when you go through the archives, you see all these letters from city officials and ordinary people elsewhere in the country saying, Mayor Humphrey, how could we get one of these in our city? It really put him and Minneapolis on the map.
It's interesting how he was able to have this, this focus on the humanity of people, kind of getting people together to get on board with this and then actually producing results. One of the things that you mentioned, we'll talk about him becoming senator in a minute. I was curious by something you said in the book. You had said that he saw himself as a liberal and a progressive. What was the kind of, I see those as two separate things. So maybe some people don't, or some listeners might see those as a lot of crossover or whatever. How do you see him as both of those things? A follow-up to that already is what that would look like today. But yeah, how did you conceptualize him as both of those
things? Yeah. So of course these, have become fighting words, and, one is reluctant to engage in that kind of boundary drawing. But at that time, in the 30s and 40s, progressive, you would use the word progressive, especially if you believed in a government acting on behalf of people. And people who were socialists would have called themselves progressives, and political parties that were open to socialists and even sometimes to communists thought of themselves as progressives. The party that Henry Wallace ultimately created very briefly in 1948 when he ran against Truman, and a party that had all too many ties to the Communist Party, was called the Progressive Party. So that word had a connotation of being prepared to challenge the worst aspects of private markets in order to protect people. And so liberals traditionally have been people who cared about less about equality and more about freedom, and believe strongly in free speech and freedom of worship and a secular public space, and the rights of everybody to pursue the interests and the values, the principles that they had. Now, these two words, they begin to blend with each other pretty early on, probably at the time of Woodrow Wilson, when all the people who were progressives and thought Woodrow Wilson was a bad guy because he was a liberal, by which they thought that meant a pro laissez-faire capitalism. As Wilson moved to the left, some of the progressives moved to the right, and suddenly progressives and liberals found that they could embrace each other. But so insofar as those two things retained different kinds of meanings, Hubert would have said FDR was a progressive and a liberal, and I'm a progressive and a liberal.
The terms don't really, they matter, they don't matter, but what do you think about, is this still a helpful thing to use today, or is this just gone by us?
It's meaningful. It's only that it obscures, I think, more than it illuminates. The progressives today are like the squad, AOC and the others. And they are highly critical of the centrist Democrats who would call themselves liberals. Joe Biden is about as classically liberal as you get. It's a word that once upon a time he would have used about himself before it came to be seen as a bad word. And yet the economic policies he's been pursuing since he became president are clearly progressive policies. Sometimes the words seem to have more to do with how impatient you are and how great your expectations are. And so liberals are people who fully recognize that everything has to be a product of compromise, and they're incrementalists and they're moderates and so on. And progressives are people who say Green New Deal, that anything short of totality of change is compromise and failure. And so perhaps that's what the difference has come to mean today. And so if that were true, I suppose you can't be both at the same time. But, these are differences of degree, as opposed to of category.
I would mostly agree with that. I think there is a distinction even currently between progressive and liberals, but there is that Venn diagram does overlap a lot though as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think also in our own time, progressives are much more preoccupied with non-economic policies, cultural policies, identitarian policies. Here's a genuine difference that did not exist in Hubert Humphrey's time and was not relevant to him, which is that I would say the big split in the Democratic Party now is between people whose primary interests are broadly cultural and identity based, as opposed to people whose primary interests have to do with the economy. And so now that's become a new progressive liberal thing. And if that's the case, I'm a liberal. I'm not a progressive.
Yeah, it's interesting how these things sort of fall out. I don't know what the right's doing nowadays, but I think they have their own way of falling out into different categories as well on that side. So I feel like this is a little bit. I mean, he was a mayor of a big city, but he runs for Senate, U.S. Senate. He doesn't do state Senate. He runs for U.S. Senate. Was that as big of a leap back then as it sort of is now? You don't see too many mayors running for Senate typically. I mean, it still happens, but usually you do.
You didn't see it then either,
Okay.
Fiorello LaGuardia was a congressman before he was a mayor. I think earlier in the century, perhaps there have been other cases. In fact, there were other cases. But then, no, it was very unusual. Now, Hubert, could have tried to be a state legislator before he was mayor.
Right.
And being mayor was an odd thing for Hubert because he was a big thinker and a political scientist and a bright young man. And mayors in Minneapolis basically were hacks. They were party hacks. Right. But Hubert, there was an opening there. There was an opening. And there wasn't an opening in Congress. And so if it had been the other way around, Hubert might have ran for Congress, but he ran for the opening that was there. He loved doing it. He could have been mayor for life if he wanted to be, but he didn't want to be. He was ambitious. He was one of those boys who dreams of being president and who other people say, someday, Hubert, I will be able to call you my friend, President Humphrey. So there was an opening. There was a not terribly impressive Republican incumbent in Minnesota. And so it made sense for Humphrey to run against.
Is it true? I could have this wrong, but since 1932, with maybe one or two exceptions, Minnesota has always been pretty blue. Is this right? I think that's most right.
The real blueness comes a little later because Minnesota had a tradition, which was a tradition in many parts of this country, of progressive Republicans. So Minnesota's famous boy governor, Harold Stassen, who became governor when he was, I think, 36 or something, was a very liberal Republican. Could easily have been a Democrat, but there was no real there was no functioning Democratic Party in Minnesota at the time. And there was a big Republican Party. So, no, there are plenty of Republicans. Both of the senators at the time were Republican. What had happened was that there were three parties, Democrats, so-called farm labor, and Republicans. And so the Republicans had all of the everybody right of center, and the Democrats and farm labor split everybody else. And so you couldn't get elected. There were times when very far left guys got elected as governor and congressman. But Hubert, one of the great achievements of his young life, was to fuse the two parties, Democrat and farm labor, to this new thing called Democratic farm labor, which is what it's called to this day, and then to drive the far left out of the party, and therefore to make it a fit instrument for himself, which he did in 1948.
That's really interesting, actually. Is there something specific about Minnesota? We don't see that happening in other states, right?
Where there's answer yes and no. Because there was an old tradition dating back to the 1890s of socialist parties in the upper Midwest. And the reason for that was that these places were settled by Scandinavians who came from a cooperative culture for whom that kind of socialism to them felt like the world they took for granted back home. And so there were North Dakota had a very far left party, which then kind of migrated down to South Dakota and to some extent across to Minnesota. And so until the two parties solidified, and that really didn't happen for absolute certain until FDR basically governed far enough to the left that there was no need for these other left parties. And they didn't have an excuse for themselves, except farm labor in Minnesota. It was the last one standing. And God knows there was certainly no other major party that had, real live Trotskyists and real live Stalinists in it. And so in that sense, it was unique. And then Hubert brought that to an end.
So tell me this then. You mentioned progressive liberal. You're mentioning, many of progressives were kind of this, or some liberals where they were about freedom and kind of anti-communist in some ways. You talk about in the book this idea of Cold War liberals. And I had a conversation with Samuel Moyne, who wrote a book on this about Cold War liberalism. It's a fascinating book. My understanding of the argument is becoming too concentrated with being anti-communist left a space where true progressive policies or ideals economically or at home were kind of not emphasized as much. And so there was too much of this preoccupation or this perseveration on being anti-communist, things like that. What kind of, Cold War liberal was Humphrey? How did he ride based on the demographics in Minnesota, being a senator from there, and then kind of what the temperature was of the country in the 50s with McCarthyism, the whole thing? How did he kind of ride this kind of line of being a Cold War liberal?
So Humphrey was the kind of liberal who Samuel Moyn ignores. And I wrote a review of Moyn's book in the Wall Street Journal. And I said it was a beautifully written book. It's an admirable book in certain ways. But it's really polemical. And he just has it in for liberals. I mean, he's a perfect example. I'm a progressive, you know, and liberals have betrayed the cause. And the people he writes about were not very liberal. But there was a whole world of people who were otherwise. And so in 1948, when there was a real fear of the far left, and this goes back to this gentleman, Henry Wallace, who ran on a progressive ticket, which was seriously infiltrated by the communists, as other leaders of the party later admitted. Liberal Democrats thought, my God, this is a catastrophe for us, because people are going to think that's what it means to be a liberal, is to be soft on communism. That's never going to fly in this country. And so a number of these people got together and created an organization called Americans for Democratic Action. This was the Cold War liberal. And it had famous people like Arthur Schlesinger and John Kenneth Galbraith, Reinhold Niebuhr, the theologian, and Hubert. Hubert was an original charter member and became the head of it early on, which is a remarkable thing. He was a mayor of Minneapolis, and these people made him their he was called a vice chairman, I think, for the title, but he really was the head of it, or the face of it, public face of it. What did it mean to be one of these people? The anti-communist side is they really feared not only communism abroad, but communism at home. And you can understand somebody like Hubert Humphrey saw that sizable parts of the political party in his own state were either real, they were either open or camouflaged communists. Major labor unions, the CIO, not the AFL, but the CIO. CIO, parts of their leadership board were communist. Their publication was controlled by communists. So they were small numbers, but they were in important places. So these people feared communism at home much more. They feared communism in its appeal to the world. And so one of the arguments they made, and Hubert made this more often than anybody, was how are we going to win the Cold War? Yes, we need to have arms. We need to be heavily armed. He was to the right of Dwight Eisenhower on military matters, certainly in terms of armaments and defense spending. But he said, it's a war of ideas. It's a war of ideas. And the people who are being fought over, above all, are the people in what we would now call the third world. And Hubert said, how are we going to win those people over if they think that other people, other brown and black people like them, get a raw deal in this capitalist democratic system? If that's what they think capitalism and democracy are, they're going to go for communism. And so the way to win the war is to push for social justice at home and to make sure the world sees you doing that. And so that's Cold War liberalism. That's why I thought Moyn's book was wrongheaded. Because for a whole generation of people, that's what it meant. It meant foreign aid abroad. It meant support for independent, non-authoritarian forces abroad. And at home, it meant civil rights. It meant health care. It meant social reforms to make people's lives better. It meant active government. That was Cold War liberalism.
So it's very interesting. This was something that was much on the minds of many people in government and maybe even regular folks throughout the 50s. And, you know, Humphrey becomes the sort of the face. You know, Truman is you know, not at his best. And he, you know, Humphrey becomes the face of Democrats in a sense for a little bit. There was this, there's some way where he becomes a leader for liberals right before we get Kennedy and Johnson and everything in the, you know, the late 50s and 60s, of course. Was this a moment for Humphrey where he was kind of, maybe not at his peak, but he was definitely part of the conversation as a leader for Democrats in the mid to late 50s?
Yeah. I mean, when you think about the period in the late 50s, when it's clear, you know, Eisenhower's moment is coming to an end. He's finishing up his second term. And the Republicans have been ruling for 8 years. And the Democrats are itching to return. And so when people are doing the early handicapping in 1958, early 1959, Humphrey's name is right on top. Now, there's this handsome young guy who hasn't done anything, but is very ambitious and making a move. His name is John Kennedy. And so people see that he's a real force. But Kennedy was a very, very crafty person, and almost everything that was going on behind the scenes. And so it became obvious later on that he, you know, was a very powerful force. But before then, it was Lyndon Johnson, Hubert Humphrey, John Kennedy, Adlai Stevenson, who'd run in 52 and 56, but was seen as kind of played out. So yes, Hubert's name was right on top.
It's interesting how he rises very, very quickly there. But I mean, you know, sometimes these things are, you know, you never know what's there. Kennedy, the rise of Kennedy is obviously tremendous in a lot of ways. Tell me about this relationship, because it will become important in a minute here about him as vice president. How did the relationship start with Lyndon Johnson, who's obviously a powerhouse? He was in the Senate. He was as president. He was this lust for power. He was very good politically. What was their relationship like? How did it kind of start? What was their dynamics in the beginning, throughout? And then we can talk about when they were vice president, but or when he was vice president. But yeah, tell me about that dynamic.
So Johnson was only 3 years older than Humphrey, but it always felt like he was more older than that.
Is that because of the status thing? He had just been in the Senate for a while. He was majority leader.
So they arrived in the Senate same time as 1949, but Johnson had spent the previous decade in Congress.
Yeah.
Johnson knew everybody who ran the show.
Yeah.
Johnson was looked upon by very senior people as an equal. Mm. Johnson understood things that nobody else understood. Johnson would tell you he's going to vote this way tomorrow. And he always would. He knew. He knew men. He didn't know issues at all. Humphrey could talk about anything for 10 hours. Johnson, it wasn't that he didn't care. It's that for him, getting something done always meant knowing the political lay of the land, knowing where the power was and operating. So when Humphrey met him, he was still very much on the outs. Johnson was on the ins. Humphrey was on the outs. He was this considered a flamethrower and a radical civil rights champion. And so nobody would talk to him. He was actually very lonely. And Johnson saw that. Johnson saw everything. He was an intuitive genius. He saw that, and he befriended Humphrey, and Humphrey was very grateful. And then Humphrey began to go to school at the Lyndon Johnson Academy. And the other liberals thought Lyndon Johnson was a racist. They thought he was this right-wing Southerner who was completely in the pockets of the oil industry in Texas, which was true. And had no more interest in their agenda than the other Southerners did. Well, Hubert had a more subtle view. He knew that Johnson, actually on economic issues, was very progressive. He hoped, he believed, he convinced himself that on race issues, Johnson really wasn't with the others, because he was from Texas. He wasn't from Alabama or Mississippi. He hadn't grown up in a feudal society. He'd grown up in a frontier society. And so, but above all, Hubert was pragmatic. He wanted to get stuff done. He wanted to succeed. And Lyndon Johnson taught him how to succeed. And Lyndon Johnson said to him early on, "You are my ambassador to the bomb throwers." Bomb throwers meant liberals. Johnson thought anybody who was just up there saying things because they're true, as opposed to, you know, operating behind the scenes to get things done, was basically an idiot, but he knew they were there and he had to work with them. And Hubert was the only one of them who actually wanted to also do things the way Johnson did. So Hubert became his apprentice. And his link to to the liberals who Johnson needed once he became majority leader, which happened in 55. And so Hubert had this extraordinary status that if you were a liberal and you wanted to get on the Justice Committee, you'd go to Hubert and say, Hubert, I want to get on Justice. And Hubert would say, well, I'll see what I can do. You know, and he would talk to Johnson and maybe Johnson would put him on. So then you'd be grateful to Humphrey. And so that was a tremendous source of power, but also a great source of skepticism, because as you can imagine, in, say, the civil rights community, they thought, how are you being such a pal with this Southern racist? So it also caused a tremendous, it was the first thing that pulled Hubert apart from the advocate community.
Mm. That's very interesting. When I was reading the book, I mean, I knew a little bit of this, obviously, but I just wouldn't, after reading all about how Humphrey was raised and his ideals and who he was and his care for people, I just wouldn't have put him together with Johnson. Johnson was again, I mean, you said it very nicely. He knew people, he knew men and politicians. Yeah, and he wasn't the greatest guy personally. Everyone knows, you know, getting the full Johnson or whatever it was, the Johnson treatment. Like, he was a bully. I mean, and, you know, I just, they seem like the odd couple almost. It's very personality-wise.
Johnson was a bully. Johnson was ruthless. Humphrey, I would say my kind of amateur psychologizing of this event would be that Humphrey's father, who was everything to him, died in 49, a few months after Humphrey became senator.
Mm.
And I think he looked for father figures.
Mm.
And I think Johnson saw that, and Johnson sort of became a kind of father figure.
Mm.
And he treated him like a bad father. You know, he brutalized him. He abused him. He mocked him. He acted like he owned him.
Mm.
And Hubert thought, okay, but I'm getting something out of this. I'm getting power out of this. I'm learning something out of this. And he was willing to live with the abuse in the way that maybe somebody else wouldn't have been. And that set a pattern that could not be broken later on when the two were president and vice president.
It's very fascinating. Real quick, before the vice presidency here, he does have this interesting chapter where he's doing some foreign affairs, right? You know, Eisenhower appoints him delegate to UN. Khrushchev, he's meeting with him. Like, what are these? How did this kind of set him up as well? Because this is true for, I think, a lot of people, right? When they're, you know, a senator or, you know, they're a congressman or whatever sort. Foreign affairs is usually seen as the kind of weak link of in a way. How did this really kind of help him and boost him and get his mindset more global? Talk about this kind of, you know, chapter here for him.
So first, remember, it's the 1950s. Eisenhower's president. Nothing's going to happen. Domestically, nothing's going to happen. And so Hubert was involved with everything, but he couldn't make any big things happen. That would have to wait for a Democrat to return. And so I think that helped propel him towards foreign policy. Now, Hubert had always thought globally from the time he was a kid. He'd always cared. He had never traveled, but he was really interested in all this. He hungered to travel. And so he started doing this in the 50s, and he couldn't believe, you know, like he could meet a head of state. Hubert Humphrey, this little boy from Dolan, South Dakota. And so that was very exciting to meet David Ben-Gurion. And Nasser in the 1950s, he couldn't believe it.
Mm.
And so he had, Johnson put him on foreign relations, and he became a very important spokesman. He was in many ways to the right of Eisenhower. He would accuse Eisenhower of, you know, truckling to the communists, which Eisenhower must have thought was pretty ridiculous. but he brought the same idealism to foreign policy, to domestic policy. He became the great champion of foreign aid in the Senate. And he really, that was part of his Cold War liberalism. How are we going to show India that their future should be with us and not with the Soviet Union? Soviet Union's giving them all this wheat and so forth, but we have to be, we're richer than the Soviet Union. We can be more generous with them.
Mm.
And so he pioneered a program that was called PL480, Food for Peace. And so that was a huge issue for him throughout his time in the Senate. Then disarmament. Mm. So Huber thought, this is crazy. We don't need all these weapons to deter the Soviets. We're locked in this crazy arms race. And so nobody cared about this at the time. And he really became the single voice in favor, first of a kind of grand disarmament. And then when it became clear that couldn't happen, then things like a limited test ban treaty for nuclear weapons. Mm. And he hammered away at this in the face of indifference and opposition for 6 years, from 1957 until 1963, when finally Kennedy agreed to pursue the nuclear test ban treaty. Mm. And it was agreed, it was confirmed by the Senate, and this Kennedy said to Humphrey, this is your baby, it better work. It was, and really more than anybody else, Humphrey was responsible for it.
Hmm. And so it's very, very fascinating. I mean, he did great work as a senator. He runs for president five times, six times? How many times?
52? I think, 60. In 60, he runs for president. In 64, he runs as vice president. In 68, he runs for president. In 72, he runs for president. And 76 doesn't really count because he kind of does and kind of doesn't and never officially does. So we'll say three times for president and once for vice president.
Yeah, so he doesn't win in 60. But a couple years later, Johnson taps him on the shoulder and says, hey, why don't you come be VP? Did Johnson know? Because there's that whole thing about, you know, Kennedy selecting Johnson for VP and that whole thing, and they didn't really get along, and it was he needed Texas and all the thing. But having been vice president and feeling pretty lousy, what was the vision, as much as we know, that Johnson had for Humphrey? Was it just, look, you're a pawn. I know how to use you. I keep you here. Go do my dirty work when I need you to clean up my mess, whatever, whatever. Or did he really want to use him in like a kind of, an instrumental way? What was the kind of idea there?
I believe, and this is an argument I make strongly in the book, that Johnson was deeply ambivalent on the subject. He had two different irreconcilable views. On the one hand, remember, there had been no such thing as an activist vice president almost ever. To some extent, Senator Nance under FDR had been his man in the Senate. But really, our modern idea, it didn't exist. So vice presidents were ceremony, one. Two, Johnson couldn't tolerate anybody who was in any way whatsoever a near co-equal. Didn't matter whether it was Hubert or anybody else. So those things said, the vice president is just going to be a doormat. But something else said something different. And that something else was that Lyndon Johnson wanted to be the greatest president America had ever known. And that meant passing the greatest legislation that America had ever passed. For that, he needed Hubert Humphrey. Hubert Humphrey had been majority whip in the Senate. He had gotten the Civil Rights Act through. He was beloved in the Senate. He could operate in the Senate. Johnson wanted to do that, but he was president. He couldn't do that. So he needed Humphrey for a lot of things. The most important was liaison to the Senate. He knew he was going to be passing all the civil rights legislation, and he decided Humphrey was the only guy who could say to his various warring cabinet ministers, knock it off. We're not going to have a turf battle. This is how we're going to decide this question. He also, early on, consulted Humphrey about State Department officials, because Humphrey knew Johnson did not know foreign policy at all. Humphrey did.
Yeah, it's very obvious with Vietnam.
Yeah, but the other stuff he did. I mean, the way he talked about it in the 50s was really ignorant. Mm-hmm. He just hadn't thought about it. He hadn't traveled.
Right.
So he needed Humphrey. He probably couldn't bear the fact that he needed Humphrey. And so these two things collided. One by one, he stripped Humphrey of all the responsibilities that he said that he, in fact, gave Humphrey. Mm. And so that by the summer of 1965, just a few months, 6 months into the vice presidency, Humphrey had nothing left. He was the chairman of the youth sports council and the space council, all the nonsense you give to vice presidents. but none of the serious stuff. It was gone.
Hmm. Yeah, you say this piece in the book that his term as VP was defined by humiliation and pathos. And he does kind of put him out there as, you know, trying to clean up stuff with the public image of Vietnam and trying to get him out there to try and, which, you know, which is not, I mean, I guess it's not unfair. I mean, you're going to try and use all the weapons you can. Yeah.
It's thankless.
Yeah. I mean, that's.
That was part of. So Hubert was still the ambassador to the bomb throwers. And so as opposition to Vietnam grew, and that was early on, starting in the spring of 65, because Johnson had not escalated during 64, because he didn't want to give Barry Goldwater anything to work with. And he said to his guys, McNamara and others, keep a lid on Vietnam until the election, and then I can decide. And he decided to escalate. And so by that time, there were a significant number of liberals in the Senate, George McGovern, Pat Lucy, and others. Johnson said, Hubert, go tell those guys why we're doing the right thing. I don't want to hear them complaining anymore. And that was a very painful job for Humphrey. And what it really meant is McGeorge Bundy, the national security advisor, would come to Humphrey's office. Humphrey would bring these guys in, and Humphrey would sit there silently at his desk while Bundy told the Senate liberals why they were wrong and why Johnson was right, which, of course, they found insulting. Mm-hmm. And think of what they thought of Hubert sitting there like a stuffed animal.
Mm-hmm.
It was very painful.
That's terrible. The one thing here is civil rights. So he's obviously there in the Senate with Johnson, where, you know, Johnson makes that big surprise where he votes in 57 for civil rights. And that was the precursor to the Civil Rights Act of 64, which we all know, and all of the legislation there. How much during Johnson's administration, I mean, as you were kind of alluding to, using the momentum after Kennedy was assassinated, using the political, you know, capital they had, pushing all that through, getting everyone in line with all of the civil rights pieces of legislation and some of the other things as well, Medicaid, Medicare, all these other things. How much of what's a fair amount, I guess, of credit for Humphrey? I mean, people have
almost none
done this. So he's just there for the ride.
He wanted to be in the room where it happened.
Right. Right.
The Voting Rights Act comes pretty early. That's 65. That's the summer of 65. Hubert still has some responsibilities there still. So he is working with the senators he knows. He's corralling votes. You know, I don't know how significant it was. I think probably not very much. And in the late summer of 65, Johnson says, he has a young aide named Joe Califano, who is a name that reappears for one administration after another. This was Califano's first rodeo. He says to Califano and to Nicholas Katzenbach, who was the acting attorney general and ultimately became the attorney general and was always responsible for civil rights, that they had to take civil rights away from Hubert. Now, why? So Johnson has all these reasons, and to me, they're all ridiculous. Johnson had told him, I want you to ride herd on the cabinet on civil rights issues. And Hubert had no doubt expanded his remit a lot further than Johnson had in mind. But he was still the right person for the job. Mm. And Johnson really couldn't have any legitimate beefs about that. And he claimed that Hubert was leaking stuff to the press. And God knows he never leaked anything as much as Johnson did. And basically, this, thank God, is very well documented. Every minute of it is documented. That Johnson has Califano and Katzenbach to a meeting in his office and says, I want you to Califano, take this over from Hubert. And Califano goes to Hubert and says, we're taking this away from you. And then he says, and I want you, the vice president. Califano, this kid, says, I want you to sign the letter that says, the time has come for me to stop doing this. I've achieved everything I could possibly achieve. And Humphrey says, I can't do that. And Califano, he says, give me a few hours. And Califano comes back later, having gotten vice presidential seal station, and typed out the letter and left a space for Humphrey to sign.
Wow.
And Humphrey signed. But Johnson's not done. And he has another idea. Well, why don't we get Hubert in here to tell the press about the fact that he's decided to step down? So, you know, he brings Humphrey in to tell him this, and Humphrey could have said, screw you.
Right.
But he couldn't do it. He couldn't do it. And so he literally says to the press, is this press conference managed by Bill Moyers, his press aide, that I'm so happy I've been able to accomplish everything I want to accomplish, and now I'm handing this over to others. I mean, what a grotesque humiliation. I mean, what an sadism on Johnson's.
Again, him as a bully is an understatement.
No, absolutely. No, he's a sadist. He gets pleasure from his control over other men.
Yeah. It's interesting because if you put the failures in Vietnam on the shelf, he's seen as one of the greatest presidents of the 20th century.
And rightly so.
There's a policy.
And rightly so.
Which tells you something though, right? Does that tell you kind of need to be an asshole to get shit done? That's crazy, right?
Well, I believe I can quote Machiavelli on this subject. Who says politics requires that you get a good man to act badly.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
There aren't that many willing to do that. So what you get instead is a bad man willing to act badly in the name of some good things, right? So, I mean, a lesser example would be Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton is a good man willing to act badly, in my view. Johnson was a bad guy who actually had some noble, even heroic impulses in him, but was a bad person. Just he was a hard, tough person who he was a creature of pure will, pure distilled will.
Yes.
But he had this depth in him. And, you know, when Robert Caro comes out with his final book, his final volume of his 5-volume series, you know, we will see this. We will see this. Mm-hmm. So Humphrey felt, you know, that he was witness to history. He was seeing great things happen. And he felt that he was doing this. And he's, you know, writing, you know, minutes and notes and this and that. Every day of his vice presidency, I'm seeing this one, I'm doing that. And, you know, it doesn't really amount to very much. But he's part of it. And that means something to him. I mean, he felt like he was doing what he could as a loyal citizen who had been asked to perform this very important office.
He runs for president on his own accord, right, in 68. And, you know, there was some changes here with the party and obviously the shadow of Vietnam. And, you know, Nixon in 68, and even first term Nixon is much different than 1972 absolutely. Nixon, which is history has been doing a 180 on this in how we talk about first term Nixon versus second term Nixon. But either way, was he close to beating Nixon? Like was it?
He thought so. He thought
it wasn't. It wasn't.
Well, so here's the thing. In some ways, 1968 looked like 1948, where Harry Truman is counted out by everybody, got no chance of winning. And then suddenly he becomes give him hell, Harry. And every day he closes and he nips Dewey at the wire.
Yeah.
The 68 campaign from a distance looks like that and was like that in the sense that in October 1st, Humphrey was not within hailing distance of Nixon. He was going to get clobbered. It was going to be a historic failure. And then every day from October 1st to November, I think 6th, he gains in the polls. And so finally, at the end, he and Nixon get almost the same number of votes. Nixon wins by 50,000, but 500,000, I'm sorry. But the electoral vote isn't close at all.
Yeah.
And it even seems a little closer to this because George Wallace takes the Deep South. And if George Wallace had not been in the race as a third party candidate, all those states would have gone to Nixon. Mm. So Humphrey always believed that if the election had gone on 7 days more, he would have won. His closest political advisors did not believe that, and said so in the aftermath, because the lead that Nixon had in key states was just too big. It probably would have gotten closer because it was trending Humphrey's way. But Humphrey just lost, you know, he lost a little bit of the left, not a whole lot. He just lost the right. All those people who we later came to call Reagan Democrats, this was the first time when they had defected. The white working class defected to some extent to Wallace, but mostly to Nixon.
Interesting. So after the loss, he licks his wounds a bit and he's senator again. And it's kind of his serving out his final years in the Senate. There's a, I believe this is correct. There's a part in the book where I think it's in the beginning, but talking about, you know, this young junior senator that just the youngest ever that got elected from Delaware, that's, you know, right there with Humphrey and that person's Joe Biden, who's now our president, which is wild to think about how we're reading books now. It's just like, what? Like, it's so wild. It's so wild.
Yeah.
But how did he serve out his kind of final years as senator? Well,
in a very interesting way. So, you know, Hubert was insatiable. He couldn't bear tranquility. He could have had a perfectly comfortable life at the end, but he didn't want it. So he runs the Senate again in 70. But he's learned something. He learned something, which is that he ran into this dead end. And the dead end was the great politics of the 1960s, that the politics of civil rights had appeared to send a message to white voters. Justice means that you guys who have now have to sacrifice for those who have not and have been left out. And so if you're a Democrat, it means you have to accept this redistributive model. Well, you can't say that to people. They're not, I mean, people who have a lot, you know, will say that. But, you know, white working class guys, you know, and women, they didn't feel like they were morally responsible for the terrible situation that black people found themselves in. They were angry about crime. They were angry about welfare. And so whatever the merits of it, the politics had failed. And so Humphrey said, we have to find a new kind of politics. We've got to find a politics that speaks to, he said, the hopes and fears of the white working class and middle class and the hopes and fears of black people at the same time. And so what that meant was Humphrey never talked about affirmative action. He tried to never talk about school desegregation, which he thought was a political catastrophe. He opposed the idea of the party having set aside seats for women and for Chicanos and black people. No, he wanted to talk about economic issues that brought people together, that crossed racial lines. And so you could say it was a class politics of the FDR kind, as opposed to a racial or identity politics of our modern. And so that was really the center. He did a million things, but that was the central thing that I would say he was focused on in his last years from 1970 until he died in January of 1978.
So what's the legacy? You spent 500 pages on a vice president and a senator, and he feels sort of forgotten. I mean, if people read your book, what are the one or two things you want people to kind of walk away with and be like, yeah, you got it. That's the legacy of Humphrey.
Well, Xavier, I would say there's a few things. Probably the first big thing is what I had said earlier, that this liberal tradition is a noble tradition and is relevant to our own times, because liberalism, as Hubert Humphrey understood it, was based in compassion, a concern for those who have less and are more vulnerable, was deeply idealistic in its sense of the possibility of doing better than we're doing right now, but was also highly pragmatic, accepted politics, didn't see politics as an evil thing that we have to engage in the hopes of somehow creating justice. No, It saw politics as the collective action of all of us. And if you believe in the American people, then despite all the terrible things that are happening, you believe in this political, this democratic political system. And he believed in democracy very deeply. So to me, that's number one. The other thing I would say is, here was this profoundly good person. He was a deeply good person. And maybe that unfitted him to become president. Maybe he just wasn't ruthless enough. But I think the fact that a man who was as good as he was could also be deeply ambitious as he was, could also arrange things in order to help him succeed, you know, which he did, could also fight ugly sometimes, which he did, without in the end losing his moral nature. And I admire that very deeply about him.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, obviously there's so many lessons to pull from for today's politicians from his life and his work. And, you know, let's see if we can, you know, have younger people that get into politics and try to be good people and to be pragmatic. James, this is such a fun conversation. I love history, I love politics. Your book was fantastic. So I've just had a big joy in talking with you. So big thanks for coming on and talking to me all about Hubert Humphrey.
Well, Xavier, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
Yes, absolutely.